your behind. We build foundations from our hips, yes. Her heart vibrato, her whole soul for melancholy reaches for the heavens. She told the trombones a different stretch, and it was her that had the trumpets well and wearing through the rim of her hat.
K-U-T-T.
She was standing at a bar in the middle of the night. She knew that she would be alright. She would leave when the band left, not stay long, and I look for a new friend to make her holler. She had taken up a cautionary measure, worn his shirt underneath her sweater, a reminder that even though he was away, it was up to her not to stray. And oh, 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 the band played on.
The impacts of queerphobic online hate are significant beyond the emotional, physical, and mental tolls on an individual. These attacks affect entire groups and communities.
Queerphobic and transphobic hate and harassment is on the rise online, not only against individuals, but also against organizations serving 2S LGBTQIA+ communities. What do we do about it? I'm Andrea Gunrad from the Canadian Women's Foundation.
Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. What about organizations and groups? What about their leaders, workers, and volunteers? The Canadian Women's Foundation notes that gender justice organizations are subject to online attack intended to delegitimize and devalue our efforts. Studies note that when organizational employees have to deal with these attacks, they have little protection. Their mental health is impacted. Precious time and resources are wasted. Employees are more likely to have to leave the digital spaces in question rather than stay and contend with the onslaught. Research also shows that those who speak about gender justice issues online face increased exposure to abuse. This may apply to community and organizational leaders as much as it applies to politicians, journalists, and influencers. Over coming months, we're delving into gender digital hate and harassment with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Today, we're joined by Stephanie Johnson, co-founder of the Ontario Digital Literacy and Access Network, or ODLIN for short. She's a PhD candidate in gender, feminist, and women's studies at York University. ODLIN raises awareness and trains organizations on the significance of digital inclusion. Its mission is to remove digital literacy and access barriers, and it provides organizations with tools, knowledge, and training to develop digital inclusion strategies. Stephanie is dedicated to building projects that build the strength and resilience of rainbow communities.
I am in Tuckeronto, also known as Toronto, which is cared for by the Anishinaabeg Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and the Huron-Wendat. I grew up with a learning disability. In high school, I struggled a lot with my studies. In grade 9, I knew I wanted to be an educator, but I really didn't know what that would look like. I thought that because of my learning disability, going to school to be a teacher just wasn't going to be a possibility. But I've always been a go-getter, and I've really been interested in developing projects that will directly help communities. I have a diploma, actually, in social work. I never pursued my master's in that. I ended up finding a lot of joy in sexuality studies and gender, feminist, and women's studies. But as somebody who suffers from ADHD, I also experience anxiety paralysis, chronic depression, and imposter syndrome. So I find it hard to focus, and I've had to dedicate a lot of time into like managing my mental health. But by doing that, I've also thrived in pursuing my past passions and like tested out what I like, what I don't like, what works for me. During the pandemic, it gave me a really big opportunity to do things differently. And one of the things I did first was I stopped working on my PhD for a few months. I stopped really doing any work when we couldn't really work. And I painted daily. So I ended up developing this multimedia art project, which is called Femdemic Creations. And I make acrylic art, which gets put on home decor and clothing. It led me to living by the motto, unapologetically creating, because at the same time, I allowed my brain to, or like my mind and my body to heal from a lot of stress of grind culture and start pursuing what was really going to like fill my cup. So a lot of the art proceeds have been used to help support Odlin. Odlin is completely self-funded. My artwork is an outlet that's allowed me to take a lot of risks and embrace the unknown. Odlin was this avenue for me to turn my PhD research into an action-based project. How are we going to get queer seniors connected during the pandemic and keep them connected and raise awareness around how not just queer organizations, but also digital literacy and access organizations can come together on meeting that need. We're basically like your guides to achieving digital inclusion. For this discussion, I will often use rainbow organizations or rainbow communities instead of the 2SLGBTQI+ acronym when possible. This research that we're going to be talking about is in partnership with Wisdom to Action. It sheds light on how rainbow organizations experience queerphobic online hate. We also received support from our community partner, Rainbow Faith and Freedom. Wisdom to Action held 6 focus groups, 5 in English and 1 in French, and they interviewed a total of 17 rainbow organizational leaders. And this project was funded by the Digital Citizen Contribution Program as part of the Canadian Heritages. We're using this research to develop digital safety planning training for organizations who serve rainbow communities.
You just released a research report entitled "The Internet is in All Rainbows: Exposing and Mitigating Online Queerphobic Hate Against 2SLGBTQ+ Organizations." Tell us about it.
Prior to starting this research, I recognized that like cyberbullying and cyberviolence was viewed by researchers as an individual problem and not necessarily a collective issue. There was a ton of research and reports done on the cyberbullying lens, and a lot of it focused on bullying in schools, different youth groups online. There was very minimal research studies on rainbow staff experiences with online hate and harassment in Canada. This gap in the literature sparked our interest to develop this study. This online hate takes so many different forms. It often manifests on social media platforms, online forums. This can also include comment sections on news outlets. People end up on our organizational websites and then use our contact us pages to, you know, send direct emails and send direct threats. And it even can happen during live online events where we get Zoom bombed. The impacts of queerphobic online hate are significant beyond the emotional, physical, and mental tolls on an individual. These attacks affect entire groups and communities. The sense of belonging and safety that rainbow spaces provide can be eroded, and this has a chilling impact on self-expression, participation, and the overall well-being within rainbow communities. So that's why it's really important that we recognize the rise of online hate as a collective issue that is threatening our human rights and our democracy.
The rise of online hate and harassment against 2SLGBTQIA+ people has been stunning. Give us a sense of its scope, form, impacts, both on individuals and groups.
Many people are very bold behind a computer screen when we're in our bedrooms or offices, wherever we decide to use the internet solo. Our filters tend to go down. A lot of people don't fully acknowledge the impact of their words or feel accountable to their actions online. Social media platforms allow individuals to connect globally. It gives them the ability to express their opinions with quite minimal censorship. And these online social spaces also increase the likelihood that individuals will encounter others who don't share similar values or political views as them. I am sure, like, we've all reported hateful remarks we see online, only to find that a social media platform doesn't view it as a violation of the community guidelines. And this becomes quite frustrating because we continue to report and get these very automated responses. Social media platforms also fail our communities by not adequately responding to reports of hate, harassment, or overt threats. In 2017, a systemic review of 27 studies from Canada, the United States, Europe, and Australia found that as many as 3 in 4 LGBTQ youth may be subject to cyberbullying. More recent studies have similarly found that gay, lesbian, and bisexual people are more likely to experience cyberbullying than their straight peers. 2018 survey of safety in public and private spaces found that transgender Canadians were much more likely than cisgender Canadians to have experienced unwanted behavior online. And many studies have captured rainbow people's experiences with being targeted online by far-right extremists. But now we're seeing this influx of mob attacks on organizations who serve our communities, which is quite scary. The people engaging in hateful acts online rationalize their opinions with over-exaggerated arguments about protecting children and cisgender women, using pseudoscientific beliefs and conservative religious ideas. These are just some perspectives that people hide behind to justify online hate speech. And we also see this increase in misinformation about gender and sexual expression that is spread on social media platforms or far-right news outlets that has put rainbow communities at risk of being attacked both online and offline.
Why are rainbow organizations targeted? What's the goal here?
I see these people who are attacking us as incredibly organized. I think they know if they destabilize our organization's infrastructure, they can start to diminish the community's power. I don't think this is something new. We're just seeing new iterations of it, but extremists, they are looking at how they can separate us and isolate us further in our communities so that they can achieve whatever their ultimate goals are. It's about our capacity to serve our communities, and this takes our attention away from what our primary goals are, which is providing programming and services that will improve the lives of queer people.
Tell us more about the distinction between online attacks against individuals versus organizations. How is it the same or different?
Online hate typically refers to hateful posts or comments about individuals or groups. This can escalate to online hate when the comments or posts are directed to a specific individual within a group or organization. And this type of harassment is meant to cause direct harm to the recipient. Doxing is an act of publicly sharing someone's information online. And by releasing this personal information, attackers can get their followers to harass individuals through various outlets like hateful emails, physical mails, phone calls, even showing up to drag shows and groups to protest. Studies on individual experiences with online hate and harassment tend to view cyberbullying as an individual problem, as I said earlier. And the suggestions within that are usually around how individuals can protect themselves. Organizations are usually called on to raise awareness about the impacts of cyberbullying and offer those direct support services, but they're not really equipped to deal with the attacks that are being directed to them as a whole. So with the rise of anti-2S LGBTQ plus hate, we're seeing more organizations, community activists, and allies coming together to protect their communities from these harms. There's also incidences where community leaders are stepping back from being in the public eye because of that fear of having that hate directed specifically towards them. During Pride 2022, libraries across Canada were subject to homophobic comments and threats of violence both online and over the phone for hosting drag story hour events. And library staff associated these events were also threatened and even doxxed online by right-wing anti-2S LGBTQI plus groups. These attacks directly disrupt our ability to provide programming to our communities, and they also make us feel unsafe, unwelcomed, and threatened in the communities we live in. And it's a direct violation of the Charter of Rights and Freedom as well.
I've been asking this of all researchers. Did anything surprise you about what you found? What gives you pause?
Our findings didn't surprise me, but rather reinforced my assumptions about professional experiences with online hate and harassment. Again, I really didn't have the information when we started this, and I had a lot of questions, but as somebody who is in the academic world, I turned to research for answers. I've been on the receiving end of online hate and harassment. So as a staff member at Rainbow Faith and Freedom, I used to manage their social media pages and moderate the comment sections. During the pandemic, I saw this huge increase in hateful responses towards RFF. I would wake up some days to a number of hateful posts, and I would spend my mornings reviewing and deleting them. Sometimes these would escalate to email threats or even phone calls. As a team, we tried to think of ways to mitigate the hate we were receiving on our social media pages. We were looking into the tools and resources to address this, but we found that they were limited and we didn't know who to speak to. We could speak to each other, but we really didn't know where to go around this. And digital safety kits were uncommon, and the ones that did exist focused on more general tactics. They didn't focus on queer organizations necessarily and the specific challenges we were experiencing. And then I also manage my friend's website. My friend is named Leslie Lee Cam, and they've given me permission to share this. Leslie identifies as a Jurassic Rainbow Senior Dyke with 47 years of community activism experience. In June, she threw the first pitch at the Blue Jays game during the Anthony Bass controversy during Pride. And this resulted in an increase of direct threats on her website. The traffic alone went up like 700% overnight, and then hateful messages were coming through. The increase in website traffic and hateful messages forced us to create a safety plan for Leslie to protect her physical well-being. This included a plan for when she was going to the event and when she was leaving the event, and also, you know, how to make sure that she felt safe at home. Threats didn't stop her from throwing the first pitch. They did put her on high alert. And because of these things happening, and this is not the first time it's happened, she's become a lot more cautious about who she talks to at events. It becomes really difficult for community leaders to put themselves out there with this fear in the back of our minds. These stories are small examples of the hate that we face daily. But what was interesting about the project is participants came up with a range of suggestions for preventing and responding. We learned that a one-size-fits-all approach does not work for rainbow organizations. So having discussions on what each of our digital safety strategies can look like will allow us to build our community strength and resilience in combating this problem.
What tips and tools do you recommend for our listeners dealing with this organizational targeting today?
Take care of yourself. Your mental health and well-being must be your first priority. If you're a social media coordinator or a personal relations manager, don't feel obligated to manage the online hate and harassment on your own. Talk to your team about how it is impacting you. And if you need to step back from that role, that's okay to do so. Continue to report hateful content online and accounts that are harassing our organizations. You can also block them, and you can choose to discontinue using problematic platforms that don't suit your needs. Be proactive. Consult with other organizations like Oldlin. We can help you build that digital safety plan. At Oldlin, we chose to leave Twitter because of the changes made to the platform under new management. We also ask other organizations who continue to use Twitter to not share our stuff on that platform. We continue to use Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn, but we're aware that these platforms are not perfectly safe. So the best we can do is have a plan. If we receive an increase in hate, what do we do to take care of ourselves?
What can we do to make digital spaces safer from the bottom up and the top down?
So most importantly, we need to call on all levels of government to provide funding to increase the capacity of rainbow organizations to safeguard ourselves from online hate and misinformation. Our insurance rates are going up. Our costs for having physical events is going up. We have to increase security measures for our organizations, and we need financial support in doing that. We also call on tech and social media companies to improve their policies and practices for addressing and preventing the rise of anti-2SLGBTQI+ and anti-feminist beliefs. All levels of government are also responsible for protecting our human rights and our democracy, so they should be holding these social media platforms accountable for not taking more action on the hate that we're receiving. Organizations, they must take action in protecting themselves from online hate. all organizations who serve rainbow communities and other equity deserving groups who are targets of online hate must have a safety plan for when these incidents occur. Upper management must provide resources and support services for all staff and volunteers, including accessible mental health supports. When online hate incidents occur, remind those who monitor these situations about the resources and support services available to them so they can manage their mental health and well-being. Staff must be involved in developing and implementing a reporting system for recording profiles that regularly attack your social media pages. Logging these incidents can assist you in filing a police report, but for many rainbow organizations, they may not feel comfortable filing a police report. So you can still use these logs to flag and block individuals who are continuing to pop up and attack you on multiple platforms. As rainbow communities, it would be beneficial to establish collaborative mechanisms across rainbow organizations to share lessons learned and ways to mitigate queerphobic online hate. So I encourage people to visit the Oldland website to access the full research report and the supplementary educational resources. We also have a really great webinar series that happened over the last few months on mitigating queerphobic online hate. So you can hear what other organizations have been doing to tackle this issue.
All right, now what? In addition to Oldland's website, Stephanie suggests checking out the Coalition of Muslim Women of Kitchener-Waterloo's website, reportinghate.ca, as well as resources on the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Find them at antihate.ca. Get the facts on gender, digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on canadianwomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless support.
GemArt Center is pleased to present When Big Man Talk, the exhibit. Come experience a captivating fusion of paintings, photography, an immersive virtual reality experience and more. To kick off the exhibit, Jam Arts is presenting the film African Redemption, The Life and Legacy of Marcus Garvey, screening January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Maison de la Culture Côte des Neiges. Then experience When Big Man Talk, the exhibit, from February 3 to 10 at Galerie Lucie Michel, and after that from February 11 to 14 at the UNIA. For tickets, call 438-507-9258 or head to jam-montreal.com and click Jam Arts Center.
Black Theater Workshop presents the world premiere of Diggers by Donna Michelle St. Bernard. Abdul and Solomon introduce Nubi Bai to the intricacies and dignity of grave digging. But when illness hits their town, they must make the best of a bad situation. Full of song, laughter, tears, and beautiful humanity, Diggers is a tribute to essential workers. Catch Diggers at the Siegel Center Studio from February 1st to the 17th. Get your tickets at siegelcenter.org or call 514-739-7944. More information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop and Prairie Theater Exchange co-production and CKUT co-presentation.
This is Matana Roberts, and you are tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM Montreal. Montreal, a city that I love, 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 love.
Thank you. So I just want people to maybe think about that. Think about my story when you're faced with that and bring that kind of empathy.
Digital hate, harassment, and violence hurt so many women, girls, and two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people. Contact creators who address gender justice like Fallon Farinacci have a lot to teach us about it. I'm Andrea Gunrad from the Canadian Women's Foundation.
Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Whether you're on social media, streaming platforms, dating, messaging, and meeting apps, or on game sites, if you're a woman, girl, or two-spirit, trans, or non-binary person, you're at greater risk of hate, harassment, and violence. There are good resources out there designed to help you better respond and take care of yourself in situations of gender digital hate and harassment. Right to Be says there's no right or perfect response to harassment. Their online harassment survival guide says it's okay to feel vulnerable and turn to your support network when you need it. They talk about how important it is to feel connected in your offline life. I often think about research that shows how people who harass and hate don't often do it from a place of power. They often do it from a place of feeling powerless. It's no excuse for hurting others, and our perceptions of our own power can get easily distorted. But what keeps us grounded? Helps us respond in better ways. Caring community. If we all had more access to caring community, connections that uphold human rights and dignity and positively challenge us to do the same, experiences of hate, harassment, and abuse would not be so commonplace. Over coming months, we're delving into gender digital hate and harassment with leading experts and content creators, releasing in-depth episodes every single week. We talk about the problem and what we can do to change it. We offer practical tips to help you in your digital life, and we talk about what it means to take back the tech for all of us. Our guest, Fallon Farinacci, is Red River Métis and a child survivor, advocate, and speaker for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and 2S LGBTQIA+ people. Fallon testified in the National Inquiry for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, sharing her story of loss and trauma. Fallon joined the National Family Advisory Circle, where she worked closely with other affected family members and the commissioners for the National Inquiry. Fallon continues to share her family story and brings awareness to ongoing genocide Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people face in hopes of bringing change across Turtle Island. A note about content, this episode addresses gender-based violence and suicide.
My name is Fallon Farinacci. My spirit name is White Thunder Woman. The elder who gifted me my name said that I'm here to make a lot of noise. When he first gave it to me, I share this quite often, I had no idea what that meant. I thought, whoa, that's a big name to fill those shoes. I wasn't quite sure what it meant. And at that point, I had been sharing my story. I had been using my voice. But I think it was at a point where I wasn't aware of it. You know, when you're sitting on, you're in it, but you're kind of sitting on the sidelines, and then you have other people that kind of tell you, no, you're actually doing it. You've been doing it for a while. That was kind of how I came to realize my name. And so now I say I do just that. I use my voice to bring awareness and to advocate as well. So I am a child survivor of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, 2S plus. I testified for the National Inquiry in 2017. I shared my story of loss and trauma with the nation at the age of 9 years old. I witnessed my parents' double murder suicide at the hands of my mother's stalker. My father was Indigenous. I am Indigenous. I'm Métis, a Red River Métis, very proud. My father instilled that in me at a young age, my whole life, I guess I should say. And my mother was non-Indigenous. My mother's stalker was Indigenous, and it was a family friend, someone we knew. I grew up with my parents. They raised myself and my two brothers in a rural Indigenous community just west of Winnipeg. It's called St. Eustache, Manitoba, holding strong at 300 people. And it still is very much a very vibrant, proud Métis community. I'm privileged. I get to go home to Manitoba. I have a connection to my home. While I was displaced after my parents passed away at 9 and I had to move to Ontario because this is where my guardian, my mother's side of the family was from, I still remain connected. And there are a lot of folks out there who something like this might happen to them at a young age and then they get displaced from their community and they lose all sense of knowing who they are. While I say I'm privileged, I also lost a huge part of my own identity and had to reclaim that for myself because no one else would do that for me. So now I do reside in Niagara on the traditional lands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe people. I raise my three children here with my husband. We are connected here with the Indigenous community here. However, when it's not your community, there's still a difference, right? Like I still bring my children home. We just went home actually this past winter to Manitoba. So my kids could experience a Red River Métis Family Day or Louis Riel Day there. So I do what I can here to have them involved and to be connected. But ultimately, you know, like my own journey, I'm realizing that's also something that they're going to have to navigate and figure out on their own. And I have to support them in whatever reconnection or reclaiming that they want to do beyond what, you know, of course, they come along with me to gatherings and traditional things. So that's a little bit about me. I'm a speaker advocate. And from speaking and sharing my story, we went to social media with that. I had this idea in 2021 that I would start a fundraiser. And that was really the catalyst to my online presence. I wanted to start a fundraiser, not for myself, for two Indigenous organizations, one here in Niagara and one in Manitoba. The goal was to raise $3,800. That was to signify the fact that I would be the first person in my family to reach the age of 38. Both my parents died before they were 38. And then unfortunately, years later, my older brother committed suicide as well from the lack of mental health support. I wanted to shift that survivor's guilt that I would be living with, knowing that I would be living with that year specifically. And so I started this fundraiser and it, in the most beautiful way, blew up. I say this about social media, it is a beautiful place, but obviously it is a dark place for the awareness that it brought and spread for the fundraiser and for MMIWG2S+. I'm grateful for the power of social media for those two things. And to date, we've raised over $100,000. I continue to try to show up in community where I can and to bring awareness and just use my voice.
We've been speaking to several feminist content creators who get so much hate and harassment in their work online. How do you deal with it in your public work? How do you respond?
It's not an easy space to navigate by any means. You can definitely get pulled into those negative comments. And at the end of the day, I try to meet those comments or those private messages not at their level, because that for me would be what would pull me away from doing this work. If I chose to answer, and that's fine. That's there. or some people that that is exactly how they want to answer. And by all means, sometimes you have to meet them where they're at, because it's just, you know, where you're also at in that moment. And so I think a lot of times people have to remember that if you ever see someone of influence or with social media and they're reacting and you think, oh, that just doesn't seem like them, they would maybe normally come at them, at that person with logic or, you know, statistics. You have to remember, this is a hard space to navigate, and we have no idea what that person is going through. They might have said that morning to themselves, like I've said many a times, I'm throwing my hands up in the air. I can't do this anymore. This is emotionally taking a toll on me. And then you're met with that kind of comment, right? So you have to remember that. But for the most part, I try to just use my voice to educate them. If I feel as though it's not going to go anywhere, that they really aren't willing to answer or to hear my answer, I will just leave it at that. A lot of times you just have to, I know a lot of creators do this, they block and delete, and they have to leave that for their own peace of mind. I think that works. But then at the same time, we have to remember we're here to try to shift people's thoughts and the way that they think and their mindsets. So at least for me, sometimes trying to give the perspective, even of myself, I never try to speak for other people when I'm coming online and I'm answering something negative someone has said. I just try to come at it from my own perspective. I've had, you know, folks look at me and just from the way I look, I acknowledge I'm white passing. Immediately I get that violence. And I also kind of sit with that and realize that there are folks out there who get the other end of the racism, right? So me being called out on white passing, I have to acknowledge that that's also a privilege that I'm in that moment, right? So it's hard, but sitting with those comments and also coming at it from a point of view of where is that person coming from? What are they living with? Why would they say this? I guess at the end of the day, trying to have understanding. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt by any means, right? And that it's something you can roll off your shoulders. But I do think that we would go a long way in life, in this world, if we just stop for a second and not react immediately. Do I think it's okay? And I'm not saying that by any means. That is my reaction, and how I answer it is to keep my own peace of mind. That's not to say that I'm uplifting someone by saying that, by deleting it or blocking or, you know, not coming at them with like a very harsh answer, which is the truth, right? Coming at them, I still come at them with the truth, but I'm doing it in a way that's protecting my own peace, which I think ultimately is the most important thing someone can do online.
I know we look at content creators and think they're so strong and have thick skin to deal with all of this. But strength can be a myth and even a trap, and it takes a lot to be strong.
Yeah, I think a part of that is also ensuring if I'm going to be strong, have a strong voice, doesn't mean first and foremost that I'm strong all the time. Acknowledging that and saying, you know, if people see me online and they're like, oh, you're so strong, I'm so, you know, it's so inspiring. It's like, yeah, but I'm going to share with you the days that bring me down, because it is hard. And having that strong voice, the only way for me I can have a strong voice is if I am supporting myself, if I'm doing the things that fill me up, that support my mental health. Because when I'm not supporting my mental health and I'm not doing the things, and I'll talk about what the things are in a moment, then I know right away. You know, at the end of the fundraiser, I use this as an example. It was like, oh, you must have felt so great. You must have felt no survivor's guilt because you raised X amount of dollars. That's not how it works. That teetered off. And then I was still left to sit with those emotions. And I thought, this is a very dark place. And I shared that online with people because I want them to see that. I think it's important. You have to be open. You know, it's, we have these platforms. And if I'm not being honest, if I'm always saying I'm like up, 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 that's not realistic. If there is someone out there that can do advocacy and this line of work and just always be on, great for you. But I don't believe that that's true. I reflected. I actually, you know, flipped the lens and looked at myself and I thought, okay, what are the things that you're not doing right now? And at the time it was, I wasn't drumming. I wasn't going out to community events. I had started to kind of pull back a little. I thought, okay, no, I need to do the things that pulled me along, that uplifted me. I shouldn't say pulled, that uplifted me so that I could do that work and be surrounded by community and friends. And I'll be honest, yesterday I was thinking, okay, you got to get back to those things. Summer was great, but you weren't like doing all the community things. You went to ceremony a couple times, but you weren't doing all of the things. And that doesn't work. You know, that doesn't make you a strong person. You can hear it in people's voices, I think, sometimes when it's like, oh, they're so strong. And then you're like, there's something in there. What is that? So I know. And it's not easy. You know, someone's going to hear this and be like, oh, I wish I could realize I'm in the thick of it when I realize that I need to be doing those things. And how do I pull out of it? You can't always, right? So you just have to, it's a new muscle that I'm constantly learning to use.
What I'm hearing is that being embedded in community is essential to your well-being when you're using your voice in digital spaces.
For me, for instance, right, being within the Indigenous community, while I'm in that, I will find people who have, who use ceremony, drumming, you know, like traditional ways to help their themselves along this journey. And then in that, I'll be having those conversations. And we all love to network. I was saying this yesterday. We all love to network, like just naturally. When we're in these groups of people that, you know, maybe it's your line of work that you do, or if you're not working within advocacy and this is something that you're doing on the side, we just naturally end up meeting people that, or introducing each other to people that can really help uplift and support. You can't do this alone. Yes, I'm using my voice, but nothing about what I'm doing is alone. It is being with community. So finding those people, those organizations, you know, maybe you're not in advocacy work right now already, but you're wanting to do some sort of work along that. Find an organization and see what kind of events they have coming up. Okay, to be completely honest, the Canadian Women's Foundation, I get the emails. From that, I find community in the words, in the writing, right? And I'm finding out about maybe things that are happening or projects that are going on. It helps support you and your mental health, your capacity of way of thinking, because you're not alone. And for someone that, like a mother, a caregiver who maybe can't get out to these things, but it is a passion and it's something that they really want to be involved in, but they can't actually physically go and be involved, these are great ways to still be a part of a community.
Your perspective of getting grounded in community is so refreshing. When we face any form of abuse, harassment, and hatred, online or otherwise, it makes us feel alone. It's designed to pull us apart and isolate us. Building community and shared experience can be a tool to protect us.
When I was asked to testify, or it was brought up, sorry, that I could testify for the inquiry, I journeyed along the entire inquiry. And then afterwards, as a part of the National Family Advisory Circle, feeling imposter syndrome as to why I was there. My father was Indigenous. We were talking about MMIWG2S+. So we're talking about women and gender diverse folks. Why was I there? My mom was non-Indigenous. So I didn't quite understand. It wasn't until the closing ceremonies that I grabbed my husband's leg and I whispered to him. We were literally, quite literally, presenting the nation with the final report. And I said, "I get it." And he said, "You get what?" I said, "I'm the girl. I was never supposed to be here. I'm the girl." And when I tell people this, they're like, "But what do you mean? Like, it was your story. You lived it. You know, you were the girl that was displaced from the community. You lived all of this." But people have to remember, it is working. It's done in a way to isolate you and make you feel that way on purpose in a unfortunately perfect way. A lot of folks don't even realize it, that they are living it, that there is an outside of it. I didn't. I just thought that was the life I was handed and I was completely alone and cool. That's what, how you're going to live your life. So I can't imagine the amount of folks that go through violence and live in danger and abuse all the time without the knowing of it. So it is important that we talk and that we share these things and that we have these communities, because, you know, as much as it matters for racialized folks that we have representation matters, representation matters also for the day-to-day of what people are enduring, and that they can see that other folks maybe lived it and that they've come out of it.
What do you think needs to change to end digital hate, harassment, and abuse? How do we go about challenging it?
How do we fight against this? Well, first of all, I wish there was no fight, that in 2023, this was not a conversation that was being had. The amount of times I actually want to throw my hands up in the air, really, if you think about the amount of times we've heard over since, say, 2020, really. Well, it's 2020. I can't believe we're still living through this. It's 2021. You know, like, how long are we going to be saying this for? Yes, obviously policies and at the larger levels within these social media platforms, that's where these changes need to come. There has to stop being this availability for the other side of those community people to come together and to feel safe in what they are saying, because that's ultimately what is happening. They feel safe and comfortable in these online spaces that they can say these things. Just as much as we have community that gathers together for beautiful, vibrant, traditional things, it makes me very aware that there are ways for these folks to come together in other ways and to share their, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say disgusting views. For me, I was taught this a long time ago from an elder that said that change happens at the kitchen table. And I thought that was so beautiful. It's especially beautiful because I'm sure this is in many Indigenous cultures. However, in our Indigenous culture, in Métis folks, we come together around the kitchen table and stories are told, and it's so beautiful, and it's a way for connection. And so if we have those conversations there, that's where change happens. As much as it might be difficult to have those conversations, that you have to, and realize that you're going to have those conversations with loved ones. And they might be the people that you struggle with the hardest, and that's okay. But we have to continue to have those conversations ultimately.
I appreciate the empathy you bring to responding to the difficulties of digital spaces. I don't think we talk enough about empathy as an element of safety and justice. We simply can't have safety and justice and freedom without human empathy and understanding. And it's not necessarily natural for us. We have to be intentional and think systemically about it too.
You know, I feel like this is a little redundant that you hear from since you're probably a child. You have no idea what that person is going through on the other side of the internet, what they grew up in. Is this their belief or is this their point of view? Those are two very different things in my mind. Maybe this will help. If you've ever heard my full story, you know, I said at the beginning of the podcast, I shared about my parents and how they were both killed. I witnessed their deaths at the hand of my mother's stalker. It was a man I knew. And in no way am I saying what he did was okay. I would 1000% want justice had he not committed suicide. I mean, I still want justice. There's much more to my story that folks, obviously I didn't share. However, he did commit suicide. I can't do the work that I do without bringing up the issue of what led him to do the things he did. Where was his mental health? Who was supporting him? He had 13 prior convictions. Where along the way did the system just think, let's just let this individual keep coasting? Where did his drug and alcohol related issues come from? Was it part of colonization as an indigenous man? What was it that he went through as a child? Were his parents a product of some sort of institution of the residential school, the 60s scoop? What kind of abuse did they endure? Was it racism that was embedded in him to be filled with this kind of hate? So when you're answering or you're seeing these comments on the other side, I'm not giving them an excuse by any means, but you can't be on the other side. I cannot be here saying the things I say without bringing issue to the fact that he himself would have went through the same thing that I went through, the fact that the RCMP fell back asleep and didn't come to our home for 6 hours to rescue us in an Indigenous community. He was a part of that community as well. So I just want people to maybe think about that. Think about my story when you're faced with that and bring that kind of empathy. Yeah, I know that's a very heavy way of looking at it, but I think we a lot of times forget that we are all humans here navigating this. And it's important that we realize that we are all part of these systems that were put in place. Maybe even think about that person as their younger self and your younger self meeting them. And what kind of empathy would that you as a child give that child if you knew what they were going through or had went through?
All right, now what? Check out Fallon Farinacci on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at Fallon Farinacci, and visit her website, fallonfarinacci.com. Get the facts on gender digital hate, harassment, and abuse by visiting our fact page on CanadianWomen.org. While you're there, read about our new Feminist Creator Prize to uplift feminist digital creators advocating for gender justice, safety, and freedom from harm. Did this episode help you? Did you learn anything new? We want to know. Please visit this episode's show notes to fill out our brief listener survey. You'll be entered to win a special prize pack. This series of podcast episodes has been made possible in part by the Government of Canada. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless support.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
TD and Production Nuit d'Afrique present Women of the World Raise Their Voices, 5 special concert evenings from February 1st to March 8th. Don't miss the grand premiere. Lidl's Cameroonian Slam, Brazilian songwriter Bia Pereira, Lorraine Classen's 40-year career anniversary, The Roots Daughters Sound System, and Cora Virtuoso, Sona Jobarte. Discover the full program on festivalnuitafrique.com. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Bless the Lord. I am Clifford Dalphy, inviting you to our Winterfest revival at the O'Brien Church. We give God thanks. February the 16th, the 17th, and the 18th. The time it will be 6:30 p.m. I would like to give thanks to the special guests, Bishop Leslie, Pastor Rowe, and Minister Mudassa. And I would like to congratulate the new pastor of the O'Brien Church, Pastor Dugan. And I'd like to thank CKUT the opportunity for this commercial. We'll give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.
A song that I wrote about not knowing what to write. I know that might sound quite indulgent, but sometimes I'm the indulging type. I hope you can hear me clearly. I need to be near you, near me. My words might not mean what yours do, but I promise that each one is true. This is a song that I wrote about not knowing what you like. Stumbling and humble, we can make a way between the nights. I hope you can hear me clearly. I need to be near you, near me. My words might not mean what yours do, but I promise that each one is true. Come here with one hand open and the other across my face. We might not leave here together, but you'll always have a place. Turn around behind my eyes, stay within my thoughts, wait here in my dreams. This thought into your hands and help me understand just how it's meant to be. Into your hands and help me understand just how it's meant to be.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.
Let me see you go back.